Tonight on Arena, Eanna Hardwick on Louis McNeice's Autumn Journal, and Jess Cav debuts her new single. Since he graduated from Dublin's Lear Academy in 2018, Eanna Hardwick has proved himself an actor of great range. Early work includes roles in Sally Rooney's Normal People and the horror film Vivarium. From there, he has gone on to play a sinister predator in The Sixth Commandment, the editor of the BBC's Newsnight in A Very Royal Scandal, and we'll see him as Roy Keane this year in the much-anticipated film Saipan. On Saturday, the 1st of February, Eanna takes on a role of Northern Irish poet Louis McNeice in a staged reading of his autobiographical narrative poem, Autumn Journal. This is the poet's masterpiece, written in the last months of 1938, a time of great tension in Europe and some sadness in McNeice's own personal life. I'm delighted that Eanna Hardwick is with me now in studio. So one of the reasons you could come to us live this evening, because you're live here in studio with us, Eanna, is because you're filming close by.
Yes, I am. Yeah, we just started on Monday. We're filming a film called No Ordinary Heist, which is inspired by the Northern Bank robbery in 2004. So week one. We're just in.
And I think you can't say very much about it, who you're playing or anything.
Yeah, it's inspired by the Northern Bank heist in 2004. And it's but it sort of looks at the human story. So it's about two characters who have to, I guess, work together and transcend their differences to save their families, among other things. And Eddie Marson is playing Richard and I'm playing Barry. So it's been a joy to be opposite him so far.
Right, and the whole, is it all shot in Dublin?
It's going to be Dublin and Belfast, yeah, between the two.
Now, a film I hope you might be able to talk a bit more about is Saipan. It's the story of, obviously, the falling out between Roy Keane, our star footballer, who in 2002 fell out with the manager Mick McCarthy in Saipan over a training ground and other football things.
Yes, a training ground, amongst other things, absolutely. I mean, that is one of my like earliest memories. That was such a massive, massive thing in my household and I guess households around the country. And it was a Cork issue, it was a national issue. So it was really surreal to get to step into that and get to play someone who's, you know, from up the road as well, kind of not far from where I'm from. So it was incredible. I loved it.
So did the script arrive? Is that how you got the part?
Yes, I had spoke to the producers of the film like quite a while before before I had read any script, and I remember at first going, I don't think I could do that, and they were very patient with me and said, well, have a think. And it was probably another year before I read a script and auditioned for Glenn and Lisa, who directed the film, and it was a brilliantly judged script, because I can remember thinking, this is football films are not, they're not 10 a penny. They're difficult to tell. You know, sports stories are difficult to tell. But I quickly got from the script that it was not a simple sort of football and tale. There was a lot going on and a lot at stake and a brilliant tone, I thought. So, it was a very exciting audition process and just really, really cool to get to play something that had been a kind of part of my life and so many people's lives.
And how difficult was it to play Roy? We all feel we know Roy Keane so well. In fact, even, you know, the recent Sky ads, he's almost sending himself up. He's such a iconic and, I suppose, lampoonable actor or figure.
I think it's the same approach to playing any part, whether someone is, you know, is real or you're playing something fictional. You kind of treat them as complex as they are. And so I did what you'd expect. I kind of read up everything I could. I watched everything I could. And that was always just that's always just what I was trying to do, was play it from his point of view and step into those shoes and not to try and do any more than that, do any sort of impersonation or try and, you know, represent the kind of, as you say, you know, the person we see in our TV screens. Because I think it's kind of, you know, it, it that's never my intention with it. But yeah, in a way, you approach it as you would any part. The only difference being that you know you've got all of this reference material to get, you know, to look at.
And it is a story that was literally divided the nation. Was Roy Keane right to look for the highest standards and leave? Or should he have stuck by Mick McCarthy, the manager who Steve Coogan is playing in the film, and Niall Quinn and the other players? So it was such a hard, I mean, you'd want to be Solomon to decide where the right was.
Well, it's that, I guess, it sets it up for great drama because both parties, both Mick McCarthy and Roy Keane, I guess they both had very, very, you know, valid outlooks and ways of doing things. And so to some degree, the film is a clash of ideas and a clash of philosophies. And, you know, you mentioned Steve Coogan playing Mick. That was sort of dream casting for me. And I, you know, it's funny, he was the person I could think, you know, I could picture in the role straight away. And so I was delighted it ended up being him. And that is much of the film, is, you know, two people with very different ideas of what the game is, I guess, going head to head. And I loved that, you know, it was, but yeah, as you said, it's split households and
from Cork, obviously, so it had a certain, even a further cachet for Cork people because it became very much the Cork against the world.
Yeah, we haven't heard that story before. I mean, it was. I mean, I can remember conversations I would have with family members and with friends at the time, and I didn't quite understand what it was or what was going on. But I just remember, I mean, Roy is and was a massive figure in my household and in Cork. So it was national news, and as you'd expect, it would be, because, you know, it was a great squad of players. It was a really exciting time in Irish football. It was a moment in time in the country. There was, you know, it was a moment of the kind of Celtic Tiger hitting its peak, and there was lots at stake nationally. So it ripe for drama, I guess.
When are we going to see it?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I guess they'll be editing the film now, so it could be any time in the next year.
And have you any reservations about the old wounds that'll be opened when they watch this?
None at all. No, I think it'll be... I remember a couple of people did say to me, like, oh God, I'm going to find this very hard to talk about again, because it was so sore. It was such a sore point especially for real committed fans, because I guess, you know, it was such an exciting time in Irish football. After a great decade, it was only getting better. And I think, but it's no harm to have something to chat about again in the pub.
Now, I won't call Roy Keane the villain, because some he's a hero,
absolutely
some
not.
He's a villain, exactly. But you have of late been playing real characters. You were in The Sixth Commandment, where you played the character Ben. Then more recently, A Very Royal Scandal, where you played the Newsnight producer. Is that something that is particularly difficult, or, as you say, it's the same process whether it's a fictional character or a real character?
I guess it depends. It depends on the story. It depends how well known the people are and stuff, and it depends if they're a recognisable face. That changes things a little bit, because you know, you're never trying to do an imitation. I guess if I've played a couple of real people in the last few years, and I guess if I've learned anything from it, it's that, you know, to approach the fictional characters you play with the same kind of depth that you have in front of you there. And it really does depend on the storytelling, because I think sometimes it is important. There's a kind of a physicality or a sort of a set of behaviours, and there's something you need to be very, very true to. And you mentioned The Sixth Commandment. I think that was very, very important, because it was a true story, and it was a very, very, it had to be very sensitively handled. And I knew that the writers and directors had done a brilliant job of doing that. But I guess from the acting point of view, I thought actually being very accurate to that man, to the person who Peter and Anne met in their lives, that man who came in and intruded and turned their lives upside down.
Yes, he's a predatory character.
A total predator who spent years sort of stalking, observing and gaslighting and manipulating.
And seducing them, which is even more hurtful. And
It was appalling. And it was very, very, a very deliberate and planned and conceited kind of crime. And So you're you know, that has to be very sensitively handled. And I think in acting terms, that just meant making sure that you were very true to the person that they met and to the man that they met, and that you, you know, you presented that accurately, actually, because it would be a disservice not to.
And in that character, he doesn't know he's evil, or does he know he's evil, or how did you feel internally? What was that character? Somebody who went about manipulating people, inveigling his way into their lives to get their money and to kill them.
Yeah, he was absolutely aware of what he was doing. So I don't think there's any kind of, you know, I guess there's sometimes that phrase, you know, people doing evil things thinking they're doing good, or that, you know, that so evil can sometimes come out that way. And I think that's true. But that was not the case here. This is someone who is, I think, quite intentionally trying to sort of dream up kind of really awful crimes and got a thrill out of thinking they could get away with that. That the whole thing was about being able to get away with it. But to be honest, I didn't dwell much on those things, because I thought, actually, I don't feel that this story needs us to unpack his psyche, because actually, you know, it's a squalid place to be, and I don't think that was what it was about. So I made sure that I did all that work and presented it, but I thought, actually, this story isn't interested, nor should it be, in unpacking his psyche, because that's not important, you know.
So we're here to talk about poetry.
Yes.
When did your interest in poetry blossom, or was it around the, you know, from the Leaving Cert?
Do you know, it probably was the Leaving Cert. I remember writing a poem in school and getting my brother to write it for me, which I can still remember that poem, because he was really good at English, and I remember going, "Would you write this for me?" And hadn't thought about poetry probably for the next 10 years until the Leaving Cert, which did a really good job, in my experience, of introducing poetry and kind of going, why would you be interested in this? And I thought it did a very good, in my case anyway. And Louis McNeice wasn't on my course, but then over lockdown in 2020, poetry just became this, it took on a whole new context for me, and it became the one thing I could read, the one thing I could give my attention to, and I kind of felt I needed to, actually. And I ended up reading every day and spending a lot of time with the same poems and kind of getting familiar with them. So it took on a whole significance for me then. And I had always had this vague idea, I'd love to do something with a long form poem. I had no idea what it was. Like, it was just this kind of back of the mind ambition. And then very luckily, an actor who I'd met in a job very kindly introduced me to James and Claire, who run Dead Poets Live. And I think not for another year and a half, 2 years later, did anything come from it. But I got a text out of the blue saying, "What do you know about Louis McNeice?" And I think I honestly said nothing, apart from he's got a lovely poem called Snow. And they sent me Autumn Journal, and I read it on a beach in Kerry and just loved it. I was just really lucky. It was something that was in the back of my mind, and then it presented itself.
So it's a poem that's in the form of a journal.
Yes.
But yet he hasn't forgotten his poetic chops. I mean, there's loads of wonderful poetry within it, even though it's presented to us as a day-to-day of his London life.
That's a great description of it, yeah, because it is like a day-to-day, in the way that a journal, you can sort of change your tune, or what catches your eye on a given day changes. And there's a great introduction to it where he says, you know, it's an honest poem because I'm not, basically I was wrong about things, and you know, I could have corrected them or edited them or amended them when we were publishing it, but that would be dishonest. I'm going to present how I was feeling when I wrote it and risk being wrong. And I think that's kind of the whole intention behind the poem, is for it to be the poetry of the everyday, for it to be very, very, almost like a conversation in a pub, to be very conversational, and then to sort of seamlessly kind of fall into beautiful lyric poetry, or quite, you know, handling quite weighty themes, like, you know, fascism spreading through Europe. And
yes, because it's important to say that he wrote it in 1938.
Yeah, the last months of 1938. So this is where the Munich crisis was kind of, it was impending, and then happens in the poem. So this is when the Nazis occupied the Sudetenland, and was sort of this red line that Louis Meunier could kind of see coming and going, this is going to happen, and then it does. So it's a poem with serious dread in it and fear, and also so that's the kind of backdrop. And then it's a love poem as well. You know, so much of it is dedicated or directed to this unnamed woman, and some of the most beautiful love poetry you'll read. So I think
it's very filmic in ways, isn't it? It's like he kind of recalls her just from the night before, or he can describe her, or, you know,
he describes all of her contradictions. Like he has some, you know, whole sort of like, you know, 18 lines of a canto, which will just be him talking about her contradictions and kind of how that drives him mad and how he loves her all the more. And it's not at all beautified or kind of like pretty. It's full of all of the ups and downs of a relationship, and that's what makes it honest. But yeah, you said it's filmic, and it absolutely is. It's full of stuff. It's full of conversations about, you know, walks you go on and parks and bars and how things feel, how materials feel. And he's a very sensual poet, and I think that's one of the brilliant, deceptively sort of genius things about him, is that he celebrates the ordinary, the everyday, and that's a kind of antidote to all of the ideology of the time and people saying, you know, if you follow this way, then, you know, that is the way, whether it be fascism or communism. Or he shunned all of that ideological kind of winnowing down, and instead he celebrated actually the kind of beautiful everyday stuff that we can all relate to.
He was a bit of an outsider himself, wasn't he? He was from Northern Ireland, as we know, living in London, but even his parents were of, I think his father was a Protestant minister.
Father was a Protestant minister from Connemara originally. I think the story goes they were run off, I forget the name of the island off Connemara that they're from. And he's born before partition. So it's a version of Irishness that I think we're probably not used to talking about. And that was one of the things that I loved about him and reading him was, you know, he is, when asked, you know, where are you from? He'd kind of go, Irish, you know, because he is Irish, and yet he sounded English to many people, and he was schooled in England. So that was a huge part of his life. But whenever he was back in Ireland, he was going down to rugby matches in Dublin, and he's a brilliant example of a kind of an Irish identity that we're probably not used to talking about, actually.
That's right, because is it Canto 16, he really takes on the new Ireland and just questions all our great heroes, Roger Casement, Griffith, other people that we hold in such high esteem. But he didn't have much truck with republicanism, for example.
He definitely shuns any ideology. I think that's his sort of thing. He's sort of unpindownable, and he questions it all. And that's a really interesting canto, because it's one of the ones that really dates the poem when you read it. And I was talking to Paula Shields, who's researching the show earlier, and we were talking about that, how it's almost like an English attitude from the period about Ireland, rather than even say a kind of a Northern Unionist attitude towards Irish nationalism or kind of the Gaelic revival and stuff like that. So he's kind of attacking from all sides, which is his sense of justice. You know, he's not taking a side. He's sort of having a go at everybody, but with tongue in cheek as well. Never with a sense of his own, you know, his own superiority or how important he is. Everything is sort of tongue in cheek and ultimately kind of taking the mick out of himself as well.
Now, you're going to perform a piece from Canto 11, but what's going to happen at the gate, Anna? So you're going to be reading from Autumn Journal, but you're kind of in conversation with other people?
So to give a bit of info on Dead Poets Live, an amazing company run by Claire Rahel, James Lever and Ollie Rouse. And this their remit and what they're trying to do is, I guess, get the work of poets on stage, get it living and breathing and get it to new audiences and celebrate it in that way. So they know one night is the same, and there'll be three nights at the gate, which will all be very different. Some will be dramatized, so kind of versions of the poet's life mixed with their poetry. Autumn Journal will be straight up the Autumn Journal, and we've abridged it for time's sake. And James will introduce it, as he does all of the Dead Poets Night. So he'll talk a little bit about the context, about McNeice, about the time, and just kind of set up the evening, really. But they're great nights. They usually happen in the Coronet in London. So I think, I don't know if this is the first time it's been done at the Gate, but I think I think
it's maybe been done once or twice before. Yes,
maybe once or twice before. I think so Denise Goff does a brilliant Sylvia Plath one, which
yes,
may have been that, over
that's
here
the
before.
One that was here. Yes,
there
yeah.
you go. Yeah, so it's going to be a great weekend. And
are there people on stage with you besides the narrator?
Yes, there are in my case. I don't know about there's the Yeats one on the Friday night and the Emily Dickinson on the Thursday with Justine Mitchell, and I'm not sure if there's people on stage for all of them, but certainly for the McNeice we'll have some people on stage that I can rely on when I'm drying and need help.
Oh yeah, so, sure.
Yeah.
And do you need to tell us anything before you read this?
I don't think so. This came to me just like kind of immediately when I was asked to pick something out, just because I'm thinking about it at the moment for no other reason than that. So maybe I'll just yeah, okay. He's talking about Nancy in this piece, so this is one of the love poem bits. At times intractable, virulent, hypercritical, with a bitter tongue, overshy at times, morose, defeatist, at times a token that the world is young, given to overstatement, careless of caution, quick to sound the chimes of delicate intuition, at times malicious and generous, at times, whose kaleidoscopic ways are all authentic, whose truth is not of a statement but of a dance, so that even when you deceive, your deceits are merely technical and of no significance. And so when I think of you, I have to meet you in thought on your own ground. To apply to you my algebraic canons would merely be unsound. And having granted this, I cannot balance my hopes or fears of you in pros and cons. It has been proved that Achilles cannot catch the tortoise. It has been proved that men are automatons. Everything wrong has been proved. I will not bother any more with proof. I see the future glinting with your presence, like moon on a slate roof, and my spirits rise again. It is October, the year God dying on the destined pyre with all the colours of a scrambled sunset and all the funeral elegance of fire in the grey world to lie cocooned but shaping his gradual return. No one can stop the cycle. The grate is full of ash, but fire will always burn. Therefore, listening to the taxis, in which you never come, so regularly pass, I wait content, banking on the spring and watching the dead leaves canter over the dowdy grass.
A wonderful piece and a wonderful reading, Aoife Hardwick. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Aoife will perform Louis McNeice's Autumn Journal at the Gate Theatre on Saturday, the 1st of February. Further details from gatetheatre.ie. Now, Janet Moran and Ronan Guilfoyle have joined forces to create Ear Wicker's Dream, a performance piece based on James Joyce's Finnegan Wake. This production blends spoken word, jazz composition and improvisation to explore the intricate world of Joyce's final novel. Following the success of their earlier collaboration, inspired by Joyce's Ulysses, Ear Wicker's Dream takes audiences deeper into Joyce's narrative, highlighting the interplay between dream and reality through live improvisations and carefully curated texts. The piece offers new insights into Joyce's enigmatic characters, including Humphrey Chipton Earwicker and Anna Olivia Purabel. Now, you're so welcome, Janet and Ronan. So this, Ronan, came on the back of your success collaborating with Janet on Ulysses. What was the Ulysses show?
Well, it was a similar idea. We used text from Ulysses, and then I wrote music around. We chose particular. Obviously, these are both Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake are very large books, so you couldn't possibly, and also you couldn't possibly do them just because of their size. You couldn't do the whole thing, the whole book with music, and also because of their structure. So with both of them, it was a question of finding a good way to use the elements of the book as a structure for a bigger, for a large scale musical piece with spoken word. So we did it in Paris and in Limerick, and we did it with musicians from France, from Paris and from Ireland. And that's kind of a theme. We've also done the same with this one because of Joyce's connection with Paris and all of that. So when we did the Ulysses first, it was of a similar idea. The music is different, though, because the text is different. So the music that I wrote was somewhat different. But the idea is similar in that we place the text, we place the music around the text, or we place the text within the music. I think one of the things that we really wanted to do was to not have one be subservient to the other, but both of them interacting with each other.
Janet, Finnegan's Wake is notoriously difficult, kind of the great novel unread. They say that about Ulysses, but they mean it about Finnegan's Wake. Had you read it? How did you approach it when Ronan suggested it?
No, I hadn't read it, and I still haven't. I had read Ulysses, and I've played Molly Bloom a couple of times.
Indeed, you've performed it here for us.
I did, yeah, and I played in the Abbey's production of Ulysses. So I knew Ulysses well, and so I worked on the text for that, arrogantly enough, but and I loved that, and I felt quite comfortable with that just because I love the book and it is so rhythmic and so musical. But it was actually my idea to do Finnegan's Wake, and then I really left Ronan in it because I was very busy, but I also looked and I thought, oh my God,
you read it, Ronan.
You read it and you do it. So God bless him. He took it on. He did the text this time. But it's very different performing it too, because there's not as much opportunity for me to interpret or make sense of it in the way that I usually would look to do when I'm kind of interpreting text. So this feels like very different in a way to the Ulysses. It's more about kind of making the text work with the music and really playing with the musicality of it.
And Ronan, then you got the job of reading the book, and then obviously people talk about its musicality. Did that come at you straight away?
Absolutely. Well, language is rhythmic anyway. People often forget about that language is about pitch and rhythm, and the more excited we become, the more rhythmic our speech becomes, and the greater the pitch variation there is within it. And Joyce uses that tremendously. The language is very musical because a lot of what the way the language is structured, it doesn't make sense in the normal way that things do, you know, typically that when we would read something. So it's quite dense and it's quite impenetrable at times, but it's actually, it's very rhythmic, it's very musical, and it's very funny because it's a huge amount of wordplay involved in it. And he has some fantastic lines that are just right in the middle of it. You'll get something like, you know, he's talking about a place where the hand of man has never set foot. Or another great line is when the angel of death kicks the bucket of life. You know, these great like wordplay things. And so much of the book is used in that. So that was really useful to me in writing the music, in placing the musicality of the language within the format of a piece of music itself.
Now, Janet, Earwicker is a character within the story, and he has sons called Sean and Sham. We have some clips here, and we're going to play the Sean clip. Do you want to maybe talk us into that?
Ronan might be better to do that, but
Ronan,
maybe
over to you.
What I tried to do a lot with this music, with the music, was to write things that are juxtaposition of what the language is saying. So doing things that were quite stereotypical sometimes with the music, to place it against the unstereotypicality, if there is such a word, of the text. So with Sean, I actually did a kind of a churchy gospel thing underneath the text of the piece. So that's what I used for this, to create that kind of contrast between this familiarity of this churchy gospel-y sound and then this very different kind of text that's above it.
Okay, let's hear that.
For I'm at the heart of it, yet I cannot on my solemn merits as a recitativer recollect ever having done of anything of the kind to deserve of such, not the first of a nation, nor by a long trollop. I just didn't have the time to. Saint Anthony guide. Have we until now ever besought you, dear Sean? We remembered who it was, good boy, to begin with, who at a symphony gave you the permit. Goodbye now, Sean replied, with a voice pure as a church mode, in echo right down.
Did you know straight away that it was a jazzy sound you were getting from Finnegan's Wake, Ronan?
First of all, jazz is way too broad to have a jazzy mm-hmm. sound. But there were lots of different things that I wanted to do because the music I'd written for Ulysses was knottier and kind of a bit more angular. Mm. But with this, because the text was so kind of knotty and angular, I felt that I would write things that were more stereotypical. So I wrote a kind of Brazilian piece in one of them. I wrote this tune. We have a funk piece. We have a lot of kind of quite kind of conventional music to go with this very unconventional text. And what's interesting about it is that we both agreed, when we started working on it, is that the music seemed to help to make more sense of the text somehow. To us, it felt almost logical at times when it was placed with the music. I mean, I definitely felt that, and that was really interesting because that was not something I was expecting, to be honest.
And Janet, in that piece, then, who is your character? You're addressing Sean in this.
Yeah, I can't remember actually. It's.
You're actually speaking about Sean.
Yes, so you're okay. So you, I don't know. I haven't read it either. And what does the music do for you when you're performing?
It's been such an extraordinary challenge for me, and obviously I've been an actor for a long time, and the kind of the job here is not to do what you normally do, which is to look for meaning and sense all the time, but to work with the music. And like Ronan was saying, I think that when you read the book, it is so dense, but when you're listening to it spoken with the music, it really becomes something else. So you experience it in a different way. So it's not really the book or the text or even that. It's like, I don't know, I love going to see things that I don't really have critical faculties for. Like I love going to see dance performances because you experience it in a different way. And I think that's what's so great about this, because it's not just a gig, it's not just spoken word, and you're not just getting the book. And all the pieces are really so different, and yet there's a great arc to the piece as well. But I'm kind of mostly along for the ride with all these amazing musicians. I keep telling them I'm the lead singer and I'm the boss, but so far they're not taking me seriously.
And Ronan, do you think you have more of an understanding of the book by engaging with it so deeply with the music?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I had to do was to try and find some kind of structural device to make the piece work in the macrocosm. And so the way I did that was by taking the main characters, which is Earwicker himself, Anna and Olivia, his wife, Shem and Sean, his sons, and Issy, his daughter, and writing pieces using text where they're being spoken about or where they are speaking, and writing the music for that. And so that gave me a really good sense of the characters, if you like. I mean, I chose text that was connected to those characters and then wrote the music around that. And so that really helped me to feel the piece structurally in a way that I hadn't before.
Yes, because Earwicker is a dreamer, and a lot then of the book is told in dreams. And the characters change into other characters, into their dream characters.
Yes, it's constantly moving. The reality is constantly changing. You don't know, is this the dream part or is this the waking part? And so using the music with that, that was... The music is very specific, so it does not, there's nothing kind of abstract about it. So when this dreamlike speech is going on over a Brazilian piece of music, which is very explicitly Brazilian sounding, or a funk piece or a gospel piece or something like that, it really brings that contrast is wonderful, because you definitely have somewhere to put your feet on, which is the music, even though this thing is floating over the top of it. So it gives it something quite different, I think.
And in performance then, Janet, the punctuation or lack of punctuation, does that help you to let sentences flow into each other?
Yeah, it does. And there are sections that have that it's easier to make sense of. But because I'm not naturally a musical person, but for me, performing with the band as well is so exciting, because I'm as aware of them. So like sometimes, dare I say, I'm not even minding the punctuation so much of the text as minding what's happening with the music and trying to kind of go with that as much as I am the text and the requirements of the text.
Well, we have another track here. This is called Shem. This is another one of this is Sean's brother. Is there anything we need to know about this in terms of music, Ronan?
No, well, the you know, Shem was a sham. You know, it's a great line about him, and he's clearly this text is saying he's a bit of a ne'er-do-well. So I kind of put in this spiky, angular kind of thing underneath that particular piece of text. Mm-hmm.
Shem was a sham and a low sham, and his lowness creeped out first via foodstuffs. So low was he that he preferred Gibson's Tea Time salmon tinned, as inexpensive as pleasing, to the plumpest roe heavy lax or the friskiest par or smolt troutlet that ever was gaffed between Leakslip and Island Bridge. And many was the time he repeated in his botulism that no jungle-grown pineapple ever smacked like the whoppers you shook out of Ananias cans, Findlater and Gladstone's corner house, England. Your inch thick blue blooded balaclava fried at beleaf steaks, or juice jelly legs of the Grex's Malton mutton, or greasily gristly grunter's goupons, or slice upon slab of luscious goose bosom with lump after load of plum pudding stuffing, all a swim in a swamp of bog oak gravy for that Greek and hearted ewed. Roast beef of old Zealand, he could not touch it. See what happens when your somatophage merman takes his fancy to our vegetarian swan. He even ran away with himself.
Well, it's fun. It's descriptive. It's a fantastic piece. Are you going to work on further Joyce work?
We'll have to see, yeah. We might run out soon, but...
Yeah, we'll see. We're definitely going to work together again. I mean, for me, working with spoken word has been kind of revelation. It's just so much fun to do. And it brings a different thing to, completely different thing to the music.
Well, my thanks to Janet Moran and Rona Guilfoyle. Earwicker's Dream will be performed on the 18th of January at The Complex in Dublin 7. Full details on thecomplex.ie. This coming Saturday, singer Jess Cav will perform her first ever solo show. This comes off the back of the successful run at the Dublin Fringe for her play Fermented Dreams, which she spoke to us on Arena about towards the end of last summer. This solo gig in the Workman's Cellar will showcase some music and old favourites. Plus, Jess will be performing with musicians and collaborators, including Louis Young and Jeff Warner Clayton. But before we talk to Jess Cav, let's listen to the new single, January Lullaby. January lullaby there, Jess Cav's recent single. Not so, it's so recent, it's out today. Congratulations, yes.
Thank
Jess.
You.
Tell us a little bit about it. There's a subtitle, January Lullaby, Shut Up and Rest.
Yes, exactly.
But it sounds like a very meditative, relaxing piece.
Yeah, very much so. I think the Shut Up and Rest is possibly a note to myself. I have noticed over many years I tend to not trust rest, you know. And I feel like even right now, you know, in this modern world, we feel like even we do rest wrong, you know, with self-care and self-care trends, you know, we have to be resting in a certain way. So last year in January 2024, I decided to go to a songwriter's retreat in the Burn. I went with my co-writer, Jeff Warner Clayton, and with my partner, and we wrote during the day, short January days, and then in the evening we'd have dinner and we'd talk, and we had a really, really beautiful week. And this is where January Lullaby was created. And we had a day, I think it was actually one of our first days, and we'd been riding all day and the sun was setting over the Burn, and it was just at the window where the producer's desk was. And I was like, hold on, I have something. And we were just about to finish. And so I really, what you hear there is what I sang. And I sang it completely intuitively. I didn't write any lyrics down. You know, and Jeff just started to follow. We started to follow on since. And it was just something that happened really, really organically after a day of songwriting. And I think it captured something really magical. And if anybody has heard of the Beekeepers, or if any musicians listening who've gone to Beekeepers, you know, there's something magical there.
It's beside the Burn, yes?
It's right beside the Burn. So it's so beautiful. It's absolutely by the Ollowee Caves, I think it's called. And yeah, so we always planned, obviously, to release it in January. And then I added the it was always going to be called January Lullaby, but I always kind of added the little thing in my head, Shut Up and Rest, because I feel like I have to sometimes really push myself to rest and to feel okay with resting. You know, I think we live in such a hyper productive world that resting feels unnatural to us, but it's so important to take that time.
So what you sang that evening is what's on the single.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to keep that magic. Yeah, so it's exactly what you hear. Now, we did a little bit of editing and so on, but what you hear is what was recorded in the Beekeepers, yeah.
So what do you feel about that sentiment of, you know, the lullaby of January? It's a notoriously hard month. It seems so long, and it's after a time of celebration, and you're just getting into the cold weather that we've all experienced.
Yeah, I think it's kind of mad that we expect, you know, to start the year in January. And I think there's a little bit more of a discourse on it at the moment, you know. You know, that spring is coming, and, you know, we're still in such darkness, and, you know, we're still, yeah, we're burnt out from maybe over socializing, or, you know, being with family, eating too much food, drinking too much. And, you know, I've always found in January that, like, I'm just not ready. I'm not ready for people. I'm not ready to get out there in the world. And I think it was something that came out of me, because it's exactly how I felt at that time. I still needed time to rest. I still needed time to figure out what I wanted to do, I guess, for the year. And to feel like I'm ready to go by spring, and by the time everybody's ready, I feel.
And did you feel it was, you know, there's too much pressure on us to try and do something, to be producing all the time?
Absolutely, yeah. I think this idea of New Year, New Me in January is just crazy. I think we need to take at least a month just to relax and figure it all out.
Now, it was a big year for you. We had you in talking about your the theatre you created,
yes,
about working in the Abbey and then going on to make your own theatre piece. But it was also a year of sobriety for you.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So,
and was that a big step, and was that did you find it a difficult year?
That's a really, really good question. I mean, Beekeepers, when we went to the retreat, that was in January 2024, and it was the start of February where I decided to quit alcohol. And it has been, yeah, I mean, it's a difficult year. I find one of the things that came to me when I began that recovery journey was, it's the big revealer. You know, when you stop drinking and you stop distracting yourself, you know, the things that you really need to work on really reveal itself, you know. And it can sometimes be almost disappointing in a way, because you quit alcohol and you go, that's the big thing I need to do. I need to quit alcohol, and everything's going to line up into place. And really what it does is that when you quit, it just kind of shows you
the work, and you're like, oh God, all right, another thing to do. But
and you were never worried that your creativity, you know, was boosted by alcohol. You had no worries around that, did you?
No. I don't think it was. I think hangovers don't really suit me, and especially the older I got. And there was moments, obviously, where, you know, being on stage and feeling a bit loose was lovely. But really, my creativity, my productivity, is when I'm, you know, well rested and maybe a little bit highly caffeinated.
Now, this is a single, so you're going to be gigging on Saturday?
Yes. So Saturday in the Workman Centre. So I decided as well this year just to kind of just make the leap, I guess, and to book the Workman Centre at the start of January, which is also my birthday. My birthday's on Friday. And the
congratulations.
Thank you very much. And yeah, we've got this amazing band together. We've got Lewis Young and Corey O'Byrne, who are playing with Brick Nasty, who is an amazing band. And we've got Finn O'Reilly as well, who's in a band called Left Iris. So the band is just absolutely outrageous, and I can't wait to play it live.
And then is this a precursor to an album?
I hope to have an album, yeah. I think what I'll be doing is releasing some singles. We have a couple of other singles coming out very soon, which will be showcased on the night to get people interested. And then I'd love to have a body of work and an album to release, absolutely.
Well, best of luck with your new single, and many congratulations on your birthday. And you can be seen in Bewley's Cafe Theatre. Oh no, your show is going to be in the Workman Cellar Saturday.
Yes.
Jess Cav, thank you so much. And
thank
best
you.
Of luck. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Harry Buckless is on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and the show was produced by Sinead Egan. Fiacna O'Brien is on next.